I'm Richard Hake in for Leonard Lopate today. Veteran producer Linda Obst has worked in Hollywood for more than 30 years, producing more than 16 feature films, including Sleepless in Seattle, This Is My Life, Adventures in Babysitting, and The Fisher King. And over that time, she's seen the film industry change significantly. Sequels are now the name of the game, and marketability, special effects, and international appeal are valued sometimes more than the writing and creativity. Her new book is called Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business, and it looks at how and why Hollywood has changed. It's her second book, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. We're welcoming you to WNYC today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you start your book by defining the new abnormal in contrast with the old. But what makes Hollywood abnormal to begin with?
Well, we're basically comprised of crazy people. You have to be crazy to be able to handle the unbelievable highs and then even lower lows and to sustain a career without quitting. Also, we attract women who leak their daughter's sex tapes in order to create a career. We attract all kinds of crazy money, often fake money, Russian mobsters. Any new hustler that comes along with a great story, whether he's for real or not, we attract famous hairdressers who turn into producers. We're pretty much a crazy place.
So was it always like that? When I'm thinking back the golden age of movies, was it still full of crazy people?
I think you have to be a little crazy to be able to do this job, but no, I think back in the studio days it was a little more organized. It was slightly less of the wild, wild west because the studios were more in control of the process, and it was less erratic. But the founders of the movie business were themselves a little bit crazy. They were old garment center workers from New York who didn't know anything about the picture business till they came out and pretty much created it.
Now, how did you personally adapt to this new abnormal while you were working at Paramount?
Well, first, I couldn't adapt. First, I went through a period where I couldn't figure out why I wasn't able to make the movies that I was able to make the first half of my career, one-offs, originals, movies I could make up while having a massage or taking a walk. And if it was a great idea and I got a terrific writer and script and I got a movie star and a director, I could make it. And then suddenly, I couldn't make those same kinds of pictures, which we now call one-offs, or originals. We used to just call them movies. And I was trying to figure out why I couldn't get those movies made. And I was complaining to my son at one of our Thursday night dinners that I couldn't understand why I couldn't get a script made that was about an intelligent design case going on in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, that was very much like the Scopes trial to me. And I imagined making a contemporary Inherit the Wind. Because we did have this religious cultural divide in our country, and I thought it was just a really interesting case. And I said to my son, why can't we make this movie? I can't understand it. It's so good. And he said to me, Mom, trying to make a movie because it's good is so 2003. So I set out to try to find out the answer to why that was.
So what of your movies that you made in the past that you wouldn't be able to get made today?
Well, a lot of them. First of all of the romantic comedies I would never be able to make now unless they were indie, unless some huge model change occurs. I certainly couldn't get Fisher King made. That would be an indie for sure, made for $5 million. I could get Contact made because we do like science fiction. I couldn't get The Siege made because it would be far too political. I think that's pretty solid.
Can you outline how a typical movie used to be pitched and then how you'd pitch one today?
Well, we pretty much don't pitch one today. Pitches are dead. That's part of the old abnormal. We used to be able to go into a room and pitch a movie, and if it was a great idea and it seemed fresh and it was high concept, we could sell it. Now, if you want to pitch an idea, you need a full presentation of a one sheet, of a graphic novel or some kind of thing that pretends to be an IP, which is an intellectual property. We used to call those books, but now we call them IPs, like The Hunger Games or Twilight Zone. And sometimes people try to make them up. They create graphic novels and pretend they have a following. And you have to create a marketing campaign. That doesn't really convince the marketing people because they're pretty smart. But what you would probably do is say, oh, I have Liam Neeson attached to that, who's a big international star. I can sell this in China because I'm going to try to get this new Chinese star, Li Bingbing. I have tons of special effects, and I have a gigantic automobile that changes into a monster, and then it changes back into a vampire.
Well, you know, here's an example. Brad Pitt's blockbuster zombie movie, World War Z, which was released last Friday, had a very troubled production. The film went through multiple rewrites and reshoots and ballooned $100 million over budget, finally costing $250 million. Is World War Z an example of a typical new abnormal blockbuster gone wrong? I mean, it only made $66.4 million on opening weekend.
Well, World War Z is fairly new abnormal in the sense that it's a IP. It was a very well-known book. It is extraordinary in the sense that an IP doesn't usually require a worldwide movie star as well. The IP is usually the star. Any form of pre-awareness will do. So a movie star is a form of pre-awareness, and a title is a form of pre-awareness. It's also very new abnormal in the sense that it's about zombies. But the way what happened in production is not typical. That was, I think, aberrational.
And how does the internet affect this pre-production?
Well, it doesn't
Getting the word out, I guess.
Well, it doesn't help a film in terms of buzz when everybody knows you're having production problems. But in the end, if the movie works, it can overcome that early bad buzz. But the internet really affects the domestic performance of the film. Because we can no longer overcome bad buzz by marketing if people start hearing the film doesn't work. And that's the one chink in the ointment for marketing, which is really ruling the opening of movies these days, is that the internet is and social media is so much faster than marketing that we can get the word out, and the word comes out that a film is not working a week or two before the movie comes out. So no matter how much money they spend domestically on letting us know how great this movie is, the people that have seen the early screenings will let us know faster than that that the movie's a clunker. And a clinker and a clinker.
Why has the international market become so important for the film industry? What percentage of the American industry, the profit is made overseas?
Well, when I first came into this business, the international market was 20% and the domestic audience was 80%. 10 years later, it's completely reversed. It replaced the collapsing DVD market that was the 50% of the profits of the old abnormal, and that's how we paid for our interstitial movies, our one-offs, our nuanced movies, our movies about writing. Now that the international market has replaced those profits, it's now 80% of our profits, and it's critical to the success of the movie business to survive that the rest of the world is seeing our movies. So now we're making movies that appeals to the international market. For example, all our movies are now in 3D, these big tentpoles. And the domestic audience doesn't like 3D, but the international audience can't get enough.
What are some of the differences that a film will be successful overseas as opposed to here in the U.S.?
Well, for one thing, familiarity. We get bored with seeing the same thing over and over again.
Is that because we have less of attention spans, you think?
No, I think it's because we crave freshness and because we have a slightly more discerning audience because these films used to be made for us and we're a little spoiled. But the international audience has just begun getting our product really around 2009, they started being exposed to extraordinary product that we made like Titanic and Avatar that had special effects that nobody had ever seen before. And they were so excited by that they wanted more and more, bigger explosions, bigger special effects. But we can't market internationally the way we market domestically. So we need familiarity, and therefore the iterations 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, like in Fast and Furious, make a movie more and more familiar overseas and therefore more want to see.
I'm speaking with Linda Obst. Her new book is called Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. Would you say that Titanic is that kind of turning point for international films?
Absolutely. Titanic was the turning point. It literally opened theaters in China and Russia that never had been there before. They started creating theaters for Titanic because so many people wanted to see it. And the kind of effects that Jim Cameron created for Titanic and then for Avatar were so wondrous that the whole world stood up and noticed, and we in America and people in South Korea and people in India and people in Brazil and people in China and Russia just stood up and cheered and said, we want more of this. And that's what we started giving them.
Let's talk a little bit about special effects. So many movies, you say, are relying on these. Why do we still hear of special effects and animation companies merging or going out of business? There was the successful one, Rhythm and Hues, which did Life of Pi, but that was bought out in a bankruptcy auction this last March.
Well, basically because special effects companies are just made of very talented groups of special effects people. So as those people start starting their own company and they no longer want to work for Rhythm and Hues, they start their own company and they get bought out. So everybody that's really talented in special effects leaves their original special effects company and starts another. And they migrate. They migrate all over the world.
And speaking of special effects, you mentioned already 3D. Are more movies being made in 3D in this country, or are they saving them for the international audience?
Well, they have to put them out in both formats in the domestic audience, and they put them out pretty much exclusively in 3D internationally.
And as far as films being funny, if you want to make a comedy, do the comedies work for an international audience, the same ones as the ones here in the U.S.?
Well, comedy is kind of a crisis internationally. Some comedies open abroad, but they turn out to be very broad comedies, not dependent on writing or wit or nuance or the kinds of comedies I used to make, for example. They're dependent on... for example, as Jim Giannopoulos said to me, falling on a banana peel is funny in every culture. So they're basically dependent on very broad physical comedy.
So how are the let's talk about the independent films. How are they adjusting to this new era in Hollywood?
Well, they're becoming more and more important, obviously, but they're being starved. So while movie stars have a different role in tentpoles than they used to have in our big movies, that is to say, they're a form of pre-awareness. They're important, but not the only factors that are important. The title is even more important than the movie star in the big studio films. In independent films, we can't make them without movie stars. So the fact that these movie stars have built up this international pre-awareness makes it possible for them to lend their name, take less money, and basically get independent films financed by using their status overseas.
Do some of the big stars, though, want to be in the independent movies, so they're kind of guaranteed a role?
They do, because they don't want to play caped superheroes. They want to exercise their chops. They want to be able to do things that are interesting, and they want to show up at Oscar time.
Now, speaking of superheroes, what would a marketing budget be for the new Superman movie, Man of Steel?
Well, by and large, the rule is it's just about as much as the production cost, almost as much. So if a movie costs $250 million, the budgeting, the P&A cost, well, it's not really P anymore because there are no prints now that we're digital, but the advertising costs are going to be fixed. They're going to be $250 million, which makes that business proposition each time a $500 million business proposition, which is why it's so tricky. It has to work. If it doesn't work, a $500 million ship goes down, which is why the whole model is so shaky.
And as far as a movie from a small independent film like Frances Ha, I mean, how much would a film like that be for a budget?
I don't think it has an advertising budget. It's basically word of mouth. It's reviews. It's internet advertising. It's repeating those reviews. But I call this the tentpole versus tadpole syndrome. The tadpoles are starved, but thank God they get made, and the tentpoles are gluttonous.
You write in the book about the writer's strike in 2007. Tell us about that.
Well, it was pretty much the most horrible moment of all of our lives. I lived through the 88 strike, and it didn't feel quite as, even though it was a bloodier, even bloodier strike, it didn't come concurrently with the recession, which made the strike even worse, nor did it come concurrently with this enormous change in models, concurrently with the DVD collapse. So what was happening is that the studios suddenly had the ability in this four-month period where they had nothing to do to reexamine their business model and say to themselves, now that we can cancel the writers' deals during the strike, do we need to bring them back? Now, in the case of movies, the answer was no. Obviously, in the case of television, which is writer-dependent, which is where all the writers started going to after this moment, which is why television has gotten so damn good, one of the reasons. In the case of television, obviously they needed their writers back. But in the case of movies, they thought, no, we can hire writers when we need them. We know what we need to make.
And just to wrap up, are many filmmakers switching over to producing TV?
Yes, producers, writers, everybody that likes making up original ideas, like series or like stories based on character. They don't like to people who don't like to see their stories wind up in the third act, everything having a resolve, and like to follow character. Yes, we're all moving to television in addition to doing movies.
I've been speaking with veteran Hollywood producer Linda Obst about her book, Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you so very much.